Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. In episode 14, season 1, I spoke with violinist and educator Subhadra Vijayakumar, who's based in Mississauga, Canada. Subhadra loves to teach people about the Indianization of the violin, and in this conversation we get to hear her beautiful playing quite a bit as she plays and demonstrates some of the guiding principles of the Carnatic style, which is the classical music of southern India. All of these episodes are available as videos, and the link is in the description. Hi, welcome to Subhadra Vijayakumar from Mississauga, Canada. And welcome, and you have agreed to play something for us at the beginning of our conversation.
Sure, thanks, Leah. And I'm going to play an invocatory piece that I play at the beginning of all my concerts. It's a Carnatic South Indian classical composition in the language of Sanskrit. Called Sri Gananatham Bajare, and it's dedicated to the elephant-headed god Ganesha. Many of you might be familiar with him, and he removes all obstacles, and it's always a good idea to invoke his blessings in the beginning. And the meaning of the song goes that he's worshipped in the faultless hearts of those devoid of passion and jealousy, and his father signifies rhythm, and his mother, the energy, and he's worshipped by all the gods. Mm-hmm. And it's set to a 3-beat cycle called Rupagataram. Tala means a rhythmic meter or formula, and Raga means the melody. And so the Raga is in Isha Manohari. So those who are familiar with Carnatic South Indian classical music will know that the music revolves entirely around melody and rhythm, and chords are really used.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So some of our listeners will be watching this on video, and some people will be listening to the podcast version. So maybe you can describe for them how it is you play that's different from Western style.
Sure. I mean, this is my mission, actually, to gain worldwide recognition for the Carnatic style of playing the Western violin. So the violin, as you can see, is identical to the Western violin. And this Indianization happened about 300 years back when South Indian musicians came into contact with the British bands that were playing in their cities, and because India was a colony of the British. Some leading musicians and composer families, they recognize that the violin has a potential because of its range of octaves and its closest approximation to human voice. And how they did the adaptation was obviously changing the playing position. So the back of the violin rests against my left shoulder, and I'm sitting cross-legged, and the scroll of the violin is placed on my right ankle. So it rests here, and this gives me an unencumbered left hand with which to play musical ornamentations that are so characteristic of Carnatic music, called gamakas. Mm-hmm. And so this 300-year-old tradition has been continuing, and from being an accompanying instrument, it has evolved to being the solo instrument.
Mm-hmm. And often used with the voice as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Still accompanying instrument for voice, for the flute, sometimes even for the mandolin. That's another Western instrument that's been Indianized, because the structure of our concerts is there's like the main artist, whether it's a vocalist or an instrumentalist, and the violin gives support, melodic and rhythmic support. And then there is the double-headed drum, the mridangam, which gives a rhythmic support entirely. Mm-hmm. So this is the ensemble for a concert, at a minimum, three people. And then my violin is tuned to the constant drone that you hear in my Shruti box.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how the strings are tuned.
Oh, yeah. So beginning with the leftmost string, it's the tonic, what we call sa, and this is the dominant pa, and then a tonic octave higher. So sa, and the tonic is variable. I mean, I have tuned it to F. Mm-hmm. If there are male singers, it would be a lower pitch. There's a female singer, it would go up to G sharp. A. So, I mean, the Western tuning classically is E, A, D, G. That's how we have adapted by changing the tuning and the playing position. For example, if you take the major scale, here if you give a gamaka in the second and the sixth note, it gives a raga called Shankarabharanam. Thousands of ragas, because with the seven notes that you have, and the minor and the major, and you apply permutations and combinations, I think there are rarely you have ragas with just four notes. You need to have five at a minimum, a pentatonic scale, and thereafter there's like comments. So the raga is identified by its ascending and descending scale, so you know what notes appear in the raga. For example, in Shankarabharanam, it's sa ri ga ma pa da ni sa do re mi fa. And then there are ragas which might take five notes in the ascending scale and all the seven in the descending. So that's another raga called Pilahari. So, mm-hmm. realize how the notes can give rise to any number of ragas.
And can you speak about the rhythm, which is such an integral part of your music as well, and how people are taught that?
Oh, yes. So right from the beginning, when you start off the beginner lessons, the scales, you start off with the minor scale where... So this is an raga called Maya Malava Gaulai, and so the tala applied is an 8-beat cycle called Adi Tala. Okay, so that goes as so you first tap, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4 and then 5 and then turn over 6, wave, tap again 7, 8. So it's set to an 8-beat cycle. So sa ri ga ma pa ra ni sa sa ni ga pa ma ga ri sa. So that will be the very first lesson. And then there are combinations of that, giving rise to the first set of 14 lessons. For example, you would do sa ri sa ri sa ri ga ma. So sa ri is 4, and then sa ri ga ma is 4 more, so it becomes 8. And then you have to do sa ri ga ma pa dha ni sa again from the first lesson. So that would be lesson 2. Mm-hmm. Where every note takes one beat and they will always be in multiples of 8. That is Adi Tala. And then you have a 3-beat cycle called Rupagataram. So the composition I played in the beginning was set to Rupagataram. Shri Ganana Tam Pachatre. So, and then there is, I believe there are 108 talas, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
Don't quote me on this. It just because these things are a little rusty, and we kind of take theory for granted. And then there's then actually right in the beginner stage, you are introduced to different talas. There is one. So those set of lessons are called Alankaras, and they are again in Maya Madhava Gaulai Ragam. And so the first one is 14 beats.
So for people that can't see you, you're counting. There's a special way of doing it with your fingers and your hands. And the audience knows this as well, right? Because I've seen when people are listening, they're involved with it in a different way.
Completely, you know, because sometimes... advanced students, or you know, even a well-educated audience, whom we call a rasika, enjoys the performance by keeping in tune with the rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they will be putting it alongside and make sure that you don't interfere with the main artist and what they have put in.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you have to match yours to what they are. Putting on the stage. But yes, it's a really good way of enjoying that, along with recognizing the melody. Raga mm-hmm. recognition is a great part of audience participation and enjoyment.
Mm-hmm. And the word Carnatic comes from a Sanskrit word that has to do with like the fact that it's classical, it's codified, so there's all these rules. Is that, that's my understanding?
Mm-hmm.
And that's distinct from folk music. Like, is there, I'm ignorant of this. So is there like different folk traditions at such a large area, South India, that are, is it quite different than the classical music, the Carnatic music?
Oh, yes. The classical music, as I said, it's actually comparable to the best traditions in the world. That's why it's on a par, if not higher, if I may say, than Western classical music. I'm a little biased because it's founded on strong principles of structure. So, and what I said earlier about being based on raga and tala, melody and rhythm. So in the classical tradition, yes, it's very strict. When we learn compositions, they are in different ragas and talas, and you cannot deviate. That would be the biggest blunder if you deviate from the notes that are assigned in that raga.
But within the structure, there's a lot of improvisation as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. Besides, you know, prolific composers in different languages, Sanskrit, Tamil, all the South Indian languages, Kannada, composers that lived 18th century, earlier to some of them. Improvisation is a very important aspect of our classical music, both North Indian tradition and South Indian classical. So India has two major classical musical forms, Carnatic belonging to the South and Hindustani belonging to the North. So going to your earlier question, yes, folk music then is all still based on these melodies. If you actually go to see, all of music revolves essentially around these notes. It's just a treatment that's different. You know, in Western classical, you use different kind of ornamentations. We use different ornamentations. And you saw how major scale is transformed into Shankaravaram. So in folk music, anything goes in a sense. They will adapt from different ragas, introduce different tunes, maybe even change the rhythm. But all of your folk music is based on classical, you know, basic raga patterns and rhythms.
So I know you have a very interesting personal story, and I want to hear about your life and your teaching and performing. But before that, could you play us another tune?
Sure. Okay, I'll play a composition in a raga called Valachi. It's a pentatonic scale. And I'll start off with a little bit of improvisation, the free-flowing improvisation. And it's in, it's again follows a three-beat cycle, Rupa Gitaram. It's called a Jalandhara, and it's dedicated to the female goddess.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you.
That was the pentatonic scale, taking these notes in the ascending and descending. So that was without the gamaka.
Mm-hmm. And one more nerdy question from a fellow violinist. Do you think in terms of positions when you change, when you're sliding up and down?
Meaning exactly?
Well, with Western violin, we talk about first, you know, all the way up to 10th position or beyond. So we really codify it in our minds that this distance is this specific spot. But it seems to me it's different with your music.
The positions are specified absolutely there. So even after you do the gamaka, you have to land on that spot.
Yeah.
For example, if I'm going back to the major scale, so so I'm going up to the next note and coming back, and then, you know, some what do you call quarter notes, I believe. But I am landing back on my reposition for sure. Those positions are there. For example, you know, there's a minor and a major for every note, right? And then, that's singular.
So the way you talk about shifting, is it different? Like, is it, because, you know, we have like whole tones, right? So we'll do like second position, third position for people who aren't violinists or string players. So is it similar, but a little bit different, the way you teach students to shift up and down the fingerboard? Like the names you use for the different positions is what I'm getting at.
Yes, so in the beginning beginning lessons in Maya Maro Gavle, and you don't introduce gamaka until after almost a year's learning. So these would be the positions, right?
Okay.
And when you start with your first, what you call a rhythmic concert opener called a varnam, the first varnam we teach is in Shankarabharanam. So we would teach them. And at this stage is when we introduce how to play like the song, like the sahityam. Until now, many of the songs would take only individual bows for individual notes. But when you come starting from the varnam or even the compositions I played earlier, you have to change the bow according to the word, the script. So as you know, we don't have a concept of sheet music and learning. So our script is straight away the solfa notes. And then the lyrics behind it. So they would, when they start the varnam, so that's what they're playing on the violin. So it has to sound like the song.
Do you teach your students to sing while they're playing sometimes?
All the time. I mean, you have to be, I mean, you don't have to have an amazing voice, but you have to sing because it's so much easier to learn your lessons. You know, you're even in the car, you're in the shower, you can memorize the lessons. I mean, that's the advantage of learning singing, whereas with the violin, you have to sit down, right? You know, you have to give the violin time. And it's so much more difficult. But to be able to do that, you have to sing and understand and prepare. even the time, the Tara signatures. Mm-hmm. For example, I'm preparing for a recital, hopefully in September, and I was learning this song, which I had learned, almost taught it to myself 20 years back, and I'm sitting and playing, and I'm convinced I am right. But obviously there was somewhere I was missing the Tara count. And so I immediately started singing it out, and then, you know, you record each line, and then you recognize where you have missed it, because mm-hmm. if you miss even a little bit, then it's not falling in that 8-beat cycle. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So singing is a must.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, you have to let go and of your inhibitions and sing. And
so you teach Carnatic violin through the Royal Conservatory of Music School, and also through your school, the Radha
Academy of Carnatic.
Mm-hmm. So yes. I'll link all of that in the description of this conversation, so people can see what you're up to in your upcoming concert and so on. And I'd love to hear about your personal story, if you want to speak to your journey to coming to Canada quite a long time ago. And
yeah, actually, it's all there in a blog I wrote when Canada turned 150 years. I felt like putting down my experiences, and I called it Canada 150, My Journey to Find My Identity. You're probably...
Yeah, I read it. Yeah, it was wonderful.
Thank you. So I started learning the violin when I was 15, back in India, and my guru, my teacher is no more. Her name was Mrs. Vijayam Ramaswamy, and she was a disciple of the preeminent violinist Sangeeta Kalanidhi, Professor T.N. Krishnan. He also passed away last year. And my entry into violin, I always quote this story, is very strange. My father was a very practical person, and I felt I didn't have a good voice. My sisters were learning Carnatic vocal, and I wanted to learn the violin. The veena, actually, because it's considered a very difficult instrument. So my father said, no veena, go learn the violin, it's easy to dispose of. So that was his, practical mentality. And so there were months when I didn't have a violin. It was like beg, borrow, or steal from friends, and because you need a violin to practice. Mm-hmm. That being said, my father, when he realized I'm really committed to this, he got me the German violin, Roth copy, that I mm-hmm. use till today. So I started learning when I was 15, and through college years, school, education was very important in our family, to get a degree, and I did my MBA as well. But music was always part of me, winning some prizes and intercollegiate competitions and that sort of, some student concerts and things like that. So I got married and came in 1990 to Canada, and I had lost my mother just before my mm-hmm. marriage. So that was pretty significant for me, and coming here and adjusting. But fortunately, the violin was there as a fallback. I'm really grateful, because I started a family soon, and so I was ended up being homebound, and my husband used to travel on work, and I had to, but hey, I had this to sit and practice, and I remember my daughter was so supportive even as a child. I mentioned that in the blog, and just to be playing around, and then I could take the violin and practice. And of course, if I had to do something more intense, I had to time it when she was sleeping or something. But overall, a very cooperative child. And so I started teaching then itself to a few students who would come. Sometimes they would even look after her, so mm-hmm. I could, teach their children. And I got more performances, and when I thought, okay, things are going to be really taking off, I had an opportunity to go out to the West and accompany some vocalists, and we were moved to Singapore with my husband's work. And over there, my Singapore sojourn has been written, I just haven't published it yet, my experiences over there. And it was amazing for violin over there because it's a small island country. So I got a lot of opportunities to play locally for Indian classical Bharatanatyam dance performances, even to go across to Malaysia and to Hong Kong as well. My son was born over there, so I took a small break, but I was able to get back. Things are sometimes a lot easier in Asia, or when you go closer to India, you know, there's a lot of like people support available over there. Mm-hmm. So it was very good. And then we were moved to England after that. Mm-hmm. And that was really tough because we were quite removed from the scene. And in England is a pretty tough place to adjust. Mm-hmm. And there was a Yehudi Menuhin school right close to where we lived in Surrey. Mm-hmm. Banging on their doors to give me an opportunity to do something, but that didn't work out. But since coming back here in 2003, I embarked on my mission. Hey, I want people to know about how the violin has been so masterfully Indianized, and the kind of the level of concerts that take place when visiting artists come, or there are very good artists here. 3-hour concerts where there's no concept of rehearsing. Mm-hmm. Mind you, they are at a very high level, so they know what the main artist is going to sing or play. So they just improv, give 3-hour concerts. And so I got very good opportunities. I became faculty at the Royal Conservatory in 2006. I started training directly under Professor Krishnan. I got a grant from the Canada Council for that. And he really honed my skills. And today a lot of people compliment me on the tone of the violin. And I owe it entirely to his rigorous training. So I got to perform all across the GTA in Mississauga on the Veranda series, Harbourfront, when they had the classical strings program. Then there was the last one I remember by the lakeside. That was a very memorable concert. Mm-hmm. Again, I mentioned it in my blog at the U of T Hart House. So, I took it to different settings. It's funny, I played even at a bar in Etobicoke. Mm-hmm. Because there's this woman who runs a show, Deirdre Malahe, that's her name. She runs a show on Omni TV. She has a very nice way of doing, instead of straight away interviewing you or something like that, she has you play before an audience to see the reaction. And so she said, this is at a bar. So I'm wondering, oh my God, I said, classical music in a bar, what am I going to do? But I said, I will play one of our fast-paced rhythmic numbers and hopefully that will click. So I just went. I didn't play with an accompaniment or anything. And the audience received it so well. And after that, the two rock musicians who came and were so taken up with it. And I was really touched and I couldn't believe it. But I guess it's music, right? So it's universal if there is an element to it that's appeals to people. So I was able to take it to different places, be it on the veranda in Mississauga or in venues like the Hart House. I also got an opportunity to render the Canadian National Anthem at the Kerner Hall on the visit of the Aga Khan. Mm-hmm. So they wanted, the anthem to be rendered on a non Canadian instrument, and mm-hmm. so there was a Masari, another memorable opportunity was to go to Japan. They were looking for some. There's probably heard of the Friendship Association. Like Mississauga City is twinned with Kariya City in mm-hmm. central Japan, and so we always have people going from here, a delegation, or people visiting us from there. And they were looking for performers that year, 2011. because it was the 30th anniversary of the twinning. And there was an opening of a new city hall in Korea City, and they wanted us to play. So I auditioned, there was this other girl on piano. We were selected, so it was, you know, very nice to take it all the way over there.
And you've done some collaborations with non-Indian style musicians as well in the Toronto area?
Oh yeah, I have. I have worked with Anne Lederman. You may have heard of her. She's a fiddler conservatory teacher, and she had roped me in for a performance at Fort York. I think for the commemoration of the War of 1812. Mm. And then I had gotten for the Harbourfront series. There was a Western classical violinist. I think, in fact, he was part of a Juno Award-winning band. And then there was Ian Bell, and he played a multitude of instruments, from the bagpipes to the guitar. And there was African-American Jaco Bacco, and then my own mridangam accompaniment, Arun Ramachandran. So there were five of us. And another memorable fusion pieces. Again, I tried to find a common language. Mm-hmm. I mean, people ask me, oh, do you then play other tunes or Western melodies? I said, no, I find the commonality between a Western classical piece or what I'm playing and link them together.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Well, it's been really wonderful meeting you and learning about Carnatic music. And I was wondering, would you be willing to leave us with one last tune?
Sure. Usually, again, you begin with Lord Ganesha, and then there are tunes and melodies, ragas, that you play at the end. Mm-hmm. So this one is in a raga called Madhyamavati. It so happens I'm choosing all pentatonic scales today. So it prays for world peace and all goodness that all of us are so much needing right now. Bhagyata Lakshmi Barama, that's the name of the song.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Subhadra.
Thank you.
Season 1 of this podcast had 20 episodes, and season 2 continues with a really interesting mix of musicians talking about their lives and careers with perspectives on overcoming challenges, finding inspiration and connection through a life so enriched with music. Please follow this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts to be informed about each new episode.